Right, so kind of repeating what we just said, how do we reverse the course? How do we reverse the course that our world is on, where marriage is disposable, where marriage, like we kind of described it, is this dirty diaper thing, where when it gets dirty, we throw it away, we get a new one, we try again. If we don't like it, we try again, etc. How do we, with our children, fix that? How do we, in our marriages, fix that? If we're going to find ways not only to make them last, but to be a light to the world. Shining examples of what marriages are supposed to be. And so 7 practical measures to prevent divorce, to make our marriages all God intends them to be. Some of them are a little longer than others, but none of it totals a whole lot when we get finished, except in information. And so let's look. 1, love even when you do not feel like loving. John 3:16, for God so loved the world, He gave His only begotten Son. Do you think God felt like loving us like that? Do you think that's emotion-based as He looks at this world and we are rebellious and reprobate in Romans 5 and verse 8, sinners? Or is it more of a love of commitment to our welfare? We are in trouble. And it doesn't matter what the relationship is. It can be siblings, boyfriend, girlfriend, best friends, cousins, work, whatever. We are in trouble in every relationship if we view love only as a feeling. If that is the only side of it we see. Feelings are fickle. Feelings are unreliable. Feelings change based on the hormones in our bodies. They change based on the weather. If it's sunny outside, we feel better than we do when it's gloomy outside. Love, however, is a command. Love your neighbor as yourself. Husbands, love your wives as you love yourselves. Wives, learn to love your husbands. And so here's the thing. You cannot command feelings. Because feelings are going to change. Sometimes, despite our best efforts to keep them from changing. But you can command commitment. And the love that God commands is rarely based on feelings. 3 Greek words that we translate love, and because we translate them all the same, sometimes we miss the point. The word phileo can be based on feelings. It is this friendship love. But true friends go beyond feelings at some point and become committed to one another. Eros is that sexual attraction, and there are some feelings involved in there and some hormones. But the love that we just mentioned, John 3:16, the love shown by God to us in John 3, Romans 5, etc. The love that's commanded of all of us, 1 Corinthians 13, when He gives us that beautiful exposition of what love is and how it acts. The love that's commanded of husbands in Ephesians 5:25 and of wives, it's not based on feelings. It is that original word, agape or agapao, agape. It's based on commitment. It's not based on feelings. It is based on a commitment of good toward another without requiring that individual to be worthy, without requiring that individual to earn it. When God says, I loved you while you were yet sinners, we hadn't earned anything. God was committed to loving us in spite of the fact that we were unlovable. And so an example of this is Matthew 5 and verse 44. When we love our enemies, it's not based on feelings. It's not based on friendship. It's not based on sexual attraction. It is based on a commitment to hope for, to work toward, to wish for the best in somebody else, whether he or she deserves it or not. When it comes to marriage, that's what we're talking about. Because there are going to be days when we wake up that the feeling is not there. That the emotion is not there because of whatever, sickness, hormone imbalance, change in things that are going on around us or inside of us, where the feelings are off. And so we're talking about a love that is committed, expressed through that commitment. Actually, in a note that a man's wife left him, they'd had a huge fight. And so Charlie's wife left him a note after the fight. "Dear Charlie, I hate you. Love, Martha." That's life. It's where the emotions say, "I'm hating you right now. I don't want to love you right now. You haven't acted lovingly towards me, and I'm not feeling it. But love, I love you anyway." There's a committed part of me that as I write to you saying, you know, I'm having trouble liking you right now. There's a part of me that says, "I love you, and it doesn't matter how much we fought. I still sign this note with my love." That's a commitment. If you've ever been married, if you've ever had a best friend, if you've ever had a sibling, you can identify that there are times that you don't like your siblings. You've just tried to gouge the other one's eyes out. You've fought like cats and dogs. But if the neighbor comes over and tries to do the same thing to your sibling, you love your sibling so much that you then go to battle beside your sibling, in front of your sibling, for your sibling. Okay, that's love. That's commitment to the welfare of that other person, regardless how you're feeling. And so marriage requires, when we look at Ephesians 5 and 25, "Husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church, gave himself up for her, did everything possible." We keep loving even though our feelings at the time may not agree. You see, we cannot always deal with emotions. We're emotional creatures. But we can always deal with decisions. We can always decide the next step, the next course of actions. So we have to learn to love God's way, by His definition, different than the world. And when we do that, we don't go into a marriage saying, "Well, I'm going to love you until I quit loving you," and then we say, "Well, I don't love you anymore, I'll go find another one." If we go into it with a commitment that I'm going to love you even when I don't love you, it's unbreakable. There's no point where you get up and say, "Well, I don't love you anymore." Because you've already purposed in your heart, you've already committed to a godly love. I've decided I'm going to love you even on days when I'm not feeling particularly close. And I'm going to act like I love you. If you act that way, the feelings will follow. The feelings will return. And understand, I'm not talking about being a hypocrite. I'm not talking about lying. You're not doing something against your will. If you're committed to loving the other person, you want to love. You want that commitment. And what you're saying is I'm going to keep doing it until the feelings get there, until my emotions catch up, till my hormones balance or the weather changes or whatever it is. Listen to me. Nobody ever said it was going to be easy. You're going into a relationship with another individual and you're taking two things that are different and making them one. That's not easy. But it can be, and it should be, the greatest connection we ever make in life. And it should be beautiful. And it should make us into the one. But since it's not easy, the feeling part of it's not always good. Are there going to be days that you wake up and feel loving towards your spouse? Absolutely. There are going to be those days that you're bubbling with it. Go with it. But on the days you wake up and you're not feeling it because he just snored really loud and woke you up out of a beautiful dream, you were sitting by the river in Italy eating cheese and crackers, it doesn't mean you slug him with the pillow. You may not be feeling it, but you commit to it anyway that you're going to love him that day too. Number two, you want to make our marriages better? And this is hard. This is hard. Zero in on positive qualities. We all have our negatives. We all have our idiosyncrasies. We are all different. We all have irritating habits. We all have sins that we battle. And when we get married, we bring them into the household with us. We may fix some of them. We may develop some others. We're real people. And even though there is a time for everything, there is a time to point out, to discuss, to work through those problems, they cannot be the focus of our marriages. We didn't go into marriage to fix each other. We went into marriage to be committed to be one individual before God. And yes, there are going to be things we fix. We're going to be better for the marriage because of the marriage. But it's not a self-help program. It's not a counseling program designed to fix everything. Focus on the positives. Focus on the strong things. Focus on the things we like. Focus on the things that drew you to your spouse. There was a reason you married that individual. There was a reason you dated that individual. Why not find those things again? Even though Paul writes to Corinth to correct problems, and it's the same with the other letters too, without fail, Paul's letters always begin with praise. They always begin with a thank you. Even with Corinth, as broken as Corinth is, he has some things to say that are good about, I thank my God always concerning you. In 6 of his 7 letters to the churches in Asia Minor, Jesus finds something to commend. Laodicea being the lone exception. Love's not supposed to be blind. Love doesn't let sin go, but it is patient. It doesn't take into account every wrong that is suffered. Love doesn't allow me, that commitment doesn't allow me to constantly keep a running tally of everything you've ever done that's wrong, so that I can point it out to you every time you irritate me. I want you to read something, and this blew me away. It was so beautiful. Sandra Milholland, she wrote these in Upreach magazine. And she said, ladies, I want you to beware of those coffee clatches. When the girls in the neighborhood are on your coffee break at work, I notice how that often husbands are skewered, cooked and eaten at those gatherings, figuratively speaking. A 10 o'clock gab session in the morning can have a subtle but powerful impact on how a wife will treat her husband in the evening, or at least view or read him in the evening. In other words, if Susie's husband did this and said that, and because he said this, it meant this, and wife gets that in her head, and she goes home, and husband uses those words, whether he means them that way or not, because Susie's planted those in her head, she's now reading her husband that way. She now views her husband that way. I mean, don't we do the opposite? We watch a television show, we watch a movie where he's the most romantic thing in the world, and we read our husbands or our wives, and they're not that way because somebody else put the thought. Sue complains about her husband. Gretchen complains about hers. Others join in with similar complaints. All men are alike. Everyone feeds on everyone else's grievances. And even if your husband has not been guilty of these faults, and I added this part, you may begin looking for them or attributing them to him. All men are the same. No. We're not. All women are the same. No. You're not. And just because so-and-so did this doesn't mean yours will. And just because yours did it last week doesn't mean she's going to do it next week. We're all individuals. We all change. We all grow. We all take steps forward and steps back. I'd like to challenge us to break that truly vicious cycle. Begin by spending time thinking warm thoughts about your husband, how he is with the kids, how hard he works, how he tries to raise them right, how he tries to do what you ask him to do. The next time your friends want to play Ain't Hubby Awful, let your responses be only positive ones. Or if you really are married to a jerk, at least refuse to join the game. Don't feed their fire. Don't turn them against your jerk. Build him up in the eyes of others. As his strengths come to mind, flaunt them. Then I added this note to her thought. Be careful. Don't make them so jealous they come after your man. But don't tear him down. And guys, this goes the other way too. When men complain about their wives, the little missus, the old ball and chain, march to the beat of a different drum. praise your woman. She had the good sense to marry you. That should say something good about her. Avoid phrases, even in joke. I have to ask the boss, the old ball and chain, because those things plant thoughts in other people's minds. And they plant thoughts in your minds. Focus on the positive qualities. Look for the good in your mate. Your mate is a gift from God. James 1 and verse 17 says what? Every good gift, every perfect gift comes down from the Father. Okay, so if your mate is a good gift from God, he or she has good qualities. Find them. What drew you to that person in the beginning? Now watch this. This is what happens when you move into a house and you corral these things into a smaller area. The things that you found endearing in the beginning may seem like flaws 10 years down the road in your marriage. Before marriage, he was decisive and you liked that. He could make a decision about where you were going to go, what you were going to do. Now he's pig-headed. Before marriage, she was loving and attentive. Now she's clingy. What changed? The perspective. The qualities that you liked before are the same qualities today, but your perspective has changed. And that's actually a scriptural thing. When Paul first met Barnabas, Barnabas' ability to see the best in everybody was a blessing to Paul. Paul was being shunned by all of the apostles. Barnabas takes him and says, look, here you go. This is what he's done. This is who he is. Accept him. 6 chapters later, when Barnabas wants to take John Mark with him after John Mark had left, now Barnabas is being pig-headed and stubborn. You may be seeing the best in him, but you're seeing too much in him. Give me somebody else. What changed? Paul's perspective. Barnabas is still Barnabas. Barnabas is still the son of encouragement. He's always going to see the best in people. So focus on the positives. Remember what drew you to your spouse. Remember that the things that are now irritating you a little bit at one time were endearing. And connected to that, understand that as you're dating young people, and you look across the table at your date and there's something about that individual that aggravates you a little bit, when you get into a house with 4 walls and it's just the 2 of you, multiply that irritation. All right, so if you cannot live with it when you're dating, don't go into a marriage expecting to change the other person, to make that person look like you want him or her to look, and understand that what was a small irritation, if he picks his nose at the table, is a huge irritation when he does it 3 times a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. Think. Get married based on commitment, not feelings. But factor the feelings in as to how am I going to feel 5 years from now when he's doing the same thing he's always been doing. And I'm tired of seeing it. Number 3, reserve time for each other. It's too easy to get caught up in all the things that we're doing. Working overtime, our kids' activities at school, our hobbies, our household, our yard work, etc. And then too late, you begin to see cracks in the foundation. James Dobson wrote a story about a gynecologist whose wife was having abdominal pain. And this gynecologist bookings, his calendar was so full, he couldn't see his own wife. So he called a friend of his and sent her to another OBGYN. Happened to be a friend of James Dobson's. My wife's having abdominal pains. I don't have time to see her. Would you please treat her? Do you mind seeing her? Do you know what the visit revealed about this man's wife? She was 5 months pregnant. Her own OBGYN husband was too busy to see it and figure it out for himself. Was he too busy? Yes. He had no idea what was going on at home. To be completely honest, I'm not sure how it could be his. I must admit, wondering how in the world this ever got attention long enough to conceive. The love Jesus showed the church in Ephesians chapter 5 that we are called to show each other is one of total commitment. We have to instill this in our children and learn it ourselves. After God, your spouse is next in the hierarchy. We had this talk with our children not long ago. Why is it on Sunday nights you and Mama go out on a date? Well, we took you with us Thursday. Why is it on Wednesday nights? And I'll just honestly, Wednesday night is our, we go to the movies 3 out of over 4 Wednesday nights in a month. We're normally the only two in the theater. Our kids are like, why are you going to the movies again? And we finally tried to get them to understand that as important as you are to us, and we had this exact talk, you do not become between us. We were married before we had you. We'll be married after you move out. Our relationship is second only to our relationship that is vertical. And it has to be that way for it to be a godly marriage. Children change the dynamic. They do not change the priority. There's actually a study that reveals that the year after the last child leaves the house, when that nest becomes empty, that empty nest syndrome, is second in rate of divorce only to the first year after marriage. Do you know why that is? It's because we spend 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, some of them never leave the house, it seems, 23 years raising our children, making a living, and then when the day after they leave, you look across the table to have breakfast with someone that you don't know who she or he is because you hadn't seen that individual in 20 years because you've been focused on your children. You've been focused on putting a roof over the house. Make time for your spouse. Date your spouse. Vacation with your spouse. Talk with your spouse. Buy groceries with your spouse. Have a hobby with your spouse. Number 4. Avoid situations that hinder the relationship. Careers are great, but if the career is killing the marriage, kill the career. If you have to work so much overtime because the boss will not let you out of it that your marriage is dying, find a new boss. It's better to live in a full, warm apartment than a cold, empty mansion by yourself. Active children are wonderful. But if you're so busy coaching and volunteering and sitting at practices and games, it is killing your marriage. Slow your children down. They cannot be the priority. It is better for your kids to see a strong marriage than it is for your kid to average 6 strikeouts a day on the mound and 4 RBIs from the plate. Friends are great. But if my friends are pulling me away from my spouse because of my attitudes, my actions, my time, it's time to cut some ties. It's time to find some mutual friends. It's time to find friends in the church and do things together. It's better to have one best friend than thousands of friends. It could be a hobby. It can be a coworker. It can be absolutely anything. Not that he had a wife, but Joseph chose to honor his first commitment rather than to give in to Potiphar's wife. It cost him his job, but he gained so much more. Don't sacrifice your marriage for something else in this world that's fleeting. Number 5, accept your share of the blame. It is the rare occasion that it is always somebody else's fault. Some of you aren't old enough to remember this. Late 70s, probably early 80s, old ring around the collar commercial, the lady's crying, the detergent failed her. Basically, she has failed and she is worthless. She is no good. Nobody ever asked why the man's collar was so dirty all the time. Why didn't the pig wash his neck? Okay, yeah, she didn't get the stain out, but why is the stain there? It's rare that it's always her fault. It is rare that it is always his fault. Maybe we should spend more time praying for the Lord to change me than for him to change my spouse. Maybe if I was a little easier to get along with, she'd be a little easier to get along with. In Luke chapter 18, You know, you got the Pharisee and you got the publican, and they're at the temple praying, and the Pharisee's worried about everything that's going on around him and what this man's doing. I'm glad I'm not like him. The publican's one concern is, Lord, make me right in your eyes. That's the only prayer he had. Let me fix myself. Really quickly, the last two. Number six, get help. It is very un-American to ask for help. Remember, we talked about the gospel of Rambo. We pull ourselves up our own bootstraps. We don't tell anybody we're in trouble. Yet, it's very biblical. We are encouraged to call for help. We are admonished to help one another, to serve one another, to confess to one another. Get help before your marriage reaches crisis level. If nobody here knows about it and all of a sudden you're divorced, we couldn't do anything to help you. So get help. Number seven, keep your marriage God-centered. We have to teach our children to find someone with the same spiritual goals. Young people, listen to me. 1 Corinthians chapter 2, Paul says there's two kind of people in the world. There are Christians and non-Christians. And then something really interesting happens. He gets to chapter 3 and he said, by the way, there are two kinds of Christians. There are worldly Christians and there are spiritual Christians. Do not go searching for an immersed heathen that just because he or she attends the Church of Christ and got the name right doesn't mean that he or she has spiritual thoughts in mind. Find an immersed child of God who is headed the same direction that you want to head. Ask some questions. Do I see this person, or do I see in this person a desire to be a man of God, to be a woman of God? Does this person have a prayer life? Does this person bring me closer to God? Or when we date, does this person pull me away from God? Whatever he or she is doing during the marriage, during the dating process, it's likely it's going to continue during the marriage process. A lot of things are not going to matter that much 10 years down the road, 20 years. We're approaching 25. The athleticism that drew you to him may disappear. The external beauty that drew you to her may disappear with age. Not really in your eyes, because your wife will always be beautiful. Your husband will always be gorgeous. If not, there's something wrong. But the popularity, what will never change is the importance of him or her loving God with that total commitment of heart, mind, body, and soul. So take inventory of the one you're looking at. Take inventory of yourself. Am I the kind of husband or wife that aids this marriage spiritually? Or am I tearing my marriage down? Am I a man of God? Am I a woman of God? Marriage takes three. And if God is not at the center of that dynamic, it will never be everything that it's supposed to be. You can make it work. You can keep it together. But it'll never be everything that it's supposed to be. Pray together, worship together, study together, serve together. God's greatest gift to you, other than your soul, was your spouse. Hand-delivered by God. I love the image of God bringing Eve to Adam. And he brought yours to you. Let's conclude. 3 weeks worth. Some other things that you can do, though, to maintain your marriage. Forgive a lot. Submit to the plan that we've already talked about. Fight fair. Certain things should be off limits when you fight. Pray, pray, and pray. And invest in your marriage. If marriage is a bank account and all you do is draw out of that bank account, sooner or later it gets empty. You've got to put something into it all the time. Talk, talk, talk. Communicate, be open. Here's the conclusion. What do we learn? 3 weeks worth, what have we learned? Number one, any study of marriage must begin and end with God's plan. One man, one woman for life, God designed. Number two, building a healthy marriage requires work because we have to sacrifice. We have to submit, we have to honor, we have to love, we have to give. God designed roles for each of us. We want it to work right, we stay within our roles. Number three, there are some practical measures that we can implement on a daily basis that will fortify our marriages against divorce, make them all they're supposed to be. Very quickly, just because your marriage has not turned out the way you wanted it to or it ended, doesn't mean that there's anything wrong with you necessarily. Sometimes we do everything we can, and the other person's so broken, or the other person changes, and we can't help. I said this in the beginning, I'll say it again. Some of the most compassionate, loving people in the world are those whose lives have been ripped apart by divorce because they know that's not the plan. Ephesians chapter 5, when Paul gives us that beautiful treatise on marriage, he gets down to verse 32 and he said, by the way, I'm not talking about marriage, I'm talking about the church. He said, the greatest marriage you'll ever have is to Jesus Christ. That takes place through the wedding ceremony of baptism. If you're not the bride of Christ this morning, if you're not part of the church, if you've never obeyed the gospel, you're missing out on the greatest spiritual relationship that there is. And it'll actually add to the relationship in your home when you put Him first. If you need to obey the gospel, please do so. Come obey the gospel and become the bride of Christ. And if you're a Christian and your marriage isn't everything that you want it to be, why don't you and your spouse come let us know that so we can work together? And if your spouse isn't here and you need help, why don't you let us know that too? So we stand and sing.